11, and that's the science panel WAG briefing. So, Dr. Downey, I'm going to turn it over to you. I say you in the pack, but I wouldn't do that. Yeah. That'd be too cheap.
Thank you, Chair Smith, members of the Commission, Director Unsworth. I'm Donnie Martorello. I'll introduce some of our other presenters, our guests here. Going to start us off with, we're here to, at your request, to talk about science and wolf management. And originally we had talked about with you, perhaps like we did a few years ago with University of Washington and invited speakers coming down, that today we talk with you, our staff, kind of a cross-section of who we are from the east side, from down south, Vancouver, and in the middle, and et cetera, and that we would review the science with you because, as I think most of you, all of you know, we look at the science constantly. I was just visiting with somebody upstairs that I believe probably on the fifth floor. There's somebody always with their nose in a scientific journal somewhere reviewing science, and so we thought it would be nice to it's always nice to have invited speakers and stuff, but today that we would share with you the science that we are reviewing and that we always review and keeping up to date on science. So this was a group effort, myself, and we have Scott Becker on the phone. He couldn't make it over this morning because the westbound I-90 is still closed, so we scrambled early this morning and got him on the phone today. And then Candace Bennett, who's a wildlife conflict specialist in northeastern Washington. Tara Meyer, who's the private lands and wildlife conflict supervisor in Southwest. And then Ellen Highheckler and Stephanie Simic, who contributed to this, but they weren't able to make it today. So with that, I'll kick us off. And before I start, you know, I've gotten in front of the commission several times and given lots of presentations, and don't get nervous very much anymore. But this one's tougher for us. This one's tougher for me. It's, you know, being a scientist my entire career, but now actually reviewing and talking about other people's work for the entire public to hear, and for these authors to hear us review their work. It's something we want to do and stuff, but it's also want to be fair to the authors, and they authors have thick skin, but we were going to review that critically and share with you kind of what our thoughts are. So before we dive into specifically the papers and the review and give you an idea of some of the stuff we're looking at, I wanted to kind of walk you through what you're going to hear today, a little bit about the role of science and management, specifically wolf policy and management, a little bit about, you know, not all science is created equal, some talk about reliable knowledge and what contributes to reliable knowledge and inference from research efforts and investigations. And then talk about the recent publications and really what is the body of science and what does that mean. And then, of course, the management implications from everything that we review and how it works its way into wolf policy and management. So a little bit on the role of science. You're going to hear me say this over and over again. Just want to get this message through loud and clear that we are a science organization. That's the backbone of who we are. We're constantly looking at science and considering that and how we shape and make decisions and policy. Science is really about hypothesis testing. It's a framework that allows folks to objectively look at questions in a hypothesis testing environment and to be able to do that repeatedly in a repeated fashion so that others can repeat that work and build upon it. A lot of folks fall into the trap that science is golden, it's the truth, and science is not the truth. Science informs us, it informs decision-making, but it's not the truth. There is, as I mentioned before, there is a diversity of different types of science out there, and a lot of folks have heard the term gray science, and there are science that's published in peer-reviewed journals, and they're not all peer-reviewed journals are the same. We now have open access online journals and those kinds of things, and other journals that are different levels of rigor and review and those kinds of things. And so there's a great diversity of degrees of the scientific efforts that are out there. And one of the parts that I was alluded to a minute ago about, you know, authors are listening, the world is listening. Fish and Wildlife Sciences, and you know this, is not laboratory science. It's folks going out there and trying to do these investigations in the most challenging environments that there are, where animals and environments don't cooperate, and a lot of confounding factors and a lot of variables that you try to measure or try to control the effects of, but it's a very challenging environment. And because of that, there's a wide range and diversity of different contributions of science. And then also, there's always the latest and greatest paper that comes out. And oftentimes we seem to kind of get caught up in that. But a single paper or a single research investigation really doesn't drive management and drive policy. If you think of each work that's out there, each publication, each research investigation, it adds another brick to the wall of knowledge. And it's that wall of knowledge really is the body of science that really is the backbone for incorporating that into our decision making and those kinds of things. That being said, as I mentioned before, it informs decision making, but you've often heard about, the role of a scientist and that of a manager and a policymaker, et cetera, that not all decisions are made on science. There are other factors that go into make decisions, but science is something that is always considered. And from this agency being a science organization or agency, that is always considered. And sometimes it's a part of decision making, and sometimes it's not. So a little bit about this concept of reliable knowledge, and studies that have different levels of information . And I'm not being critical here of different studies. This is just a recognition of how challenging the landscape is. But we're going to hear a little less than 10 studies we're going to talk about today. And you'll hear some of those that have a very robust design and some of those that are less so. And it's just an artifact of how that research was conducted and what environment is in, et cetera. And so to give you an idea of that, think about an evaluation of a subpopulation trends, where you just have trend information that maybe it's flatlined or slightly increasing or slightly decreasing for just a subpopulation in a part of a state or a part of a GMU or a part of a county. And beyond that, you really don't know much other than, it seems that population is stable or slightly increasing or slightly decreasing. And there's a lot of information out there, and it's oftentimes you want to draw greater inferences beyond that, but you really can't. And then if you think about this in gradations towards more informative bodies of work, think about a research investigation that actually hangs collars on a critter and estimates their demographics, birth rate or survivorship or those kinds of things. Another layer into that population, another layer of science now that is a little more informative, especially if you tack it on to, as we talked about just a moment ago, the baseline information or the trend information. And then incrementally here going to more informative, think about a science or a study application where maybe there's a treatment, apply some treatment to a population, and then you measure the response. Maybe you release animals to augment a population, or you do something like that and you measure response. And then the next level, and this goes on and on, but one of the even more informative, and you'll hear in a paper today, the kind of a gold standard, if you will, is really thinking about a controlled treatment design where you randomly apply a treatment in one of the study areas and not the control, and then you replicate that either in time or space. So you have replicates where you're randomly assigning something to treatment control, and that allows you to control the other variables that are out there by having that kind of more robust design. And so that gives you an idea that even the studies are different levels of that. They provide different levels of information. We have to think about the inference of that information. If that's not challenging enough, and when you go out and you do this in the real world out there, environmental conditions are different in many areas you go to. And so you have to think about, as we review studies and others do, what the inferences of that research investigation, and whether that applies to Washington or this corner of Washington or those kinds of things. Environmental conditions, of course, are quite variable. They can change in, factors or conditions can change in time and space. What's in one system that we look at in Yellowstone may be a different composition of species than in what's in Washington, and that has some impacts. There may be confounding variables that weren't aware of in a study that are part of Washington and maybe not another area. And it could be a number of different things. And then, of course, maybe not tied to inference, but every study has its own level of precision and accuracy and the power of the statistical test. all of that goes into when you review a manuscript or review a study and whether, you know, what you can learn from that or glean from that. So I'm obviously not going to read all of this. There is a stack of papers about this tall of all the stuff that we look at. And 3 or 4 years ago, the University of Washington, with some other organizations, hosted a science review panel where they actually had, and I think some of you were there, where they actually had some scientists kind of come out and present their work. I was a part of that, and that information is all available online. There's actually YouTube clips of all the presentations and a white paper that the University of Washington produced. And we're building on that now. There's a little bit of overlap here with one of the manuscripts, but other than that, these are all new. And we have about seven different manuscripts, or six different manuscripts that we're going to talk about, and then a little bit of information on the Northern Rocky Mountains ecosystem and things we can glean from that ecosystem into Washington. So with that, I'll kick us off into one of the first works, and I think... Mr. Chair, we'd hold questions till the very end, or how do you want to handle that?
Yeah, and I think that's probably best, yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to dive into this, and we have, like I said, we have six different papers, and I'll be passing the mic here to others to for some of those. I'll do a few. So the first one is by author Chaperon and Trevis in 2016, the title, Blood Does Not Buy Goodwill, Allowing Calling Increases Poaching of Large Carnivores. And this was a piece, some work that was done as a retrospective analysis that was in Wisconsin and Michigan. You can see the two graphs that I have here, excuse my reach, up on the slide. And what you see here is a lot like Washington, is the through time from 95 to 2012, this increase in the wolf population in those two states. And then the bar graphs here show the years that the states... or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service used calling to address conflict on the landscape. And you can see there are years there were no calling and then years there was calling. And the approach that these researchers used is to investigate whether there was a signal, for now we're into the kind of the social behavior side, whether there was a signal to the public that when there was they were going to do calling of wolves, did that actually decrease poaching? The hypothesis was that liberalized wolf calling, having more calling, reduces poaching, improves wolf population status in that region. So that was the test that they were doing. And they had, for each of these states were independent, they had, it's not based on year, but they had six of these periods of signals where they had calling. For each state, so they had 12 replicates of that, where they had 12 signals combining the two states. A little bit here on how they analyze that. If you think about this axis as time, this one is population size, and there's a rate here, which is a wolf population growth rate, and then a wolf population size, and then after calling, the revised wolf population size minus the animals that were called. And so here's that trajectory of growth rate. We take that same idea right here and apply it to what they're testing, that you would expect then if there was less poaching, that the growth rate, and this is in a period of time, the growth rate would increase. Of course, there's a constant for calling, but the end product, you would see an increased population because the growth rate was increasing, because calling actually, they're testing this, reduced poaching. So when they applied that, and I'll get to the data here in just a moment, they found just the opposite, and that when the growth rate and then a period where it actually, and this is, we'll talk about this as assumptions and things, where there's a period where it actually increased poaching, and therefore the growth rate was reduced, and of course minus the calling and the end population was much lower than it started. So there's their outcome. Liberalizing wolf calling did not reduce poaching or improve wolf population status. Here for Wisconsin, you see this is, I got the growth rates here with no signals, a 16% growth rate, confidence, 95% confidence interval of 12 to 20% growth rate. With a signal, it was reduced growth rate to 12%, and you can see the corresponding confidence interval. Similar pattern here in Michigan where no signal, there's the growth rate of 14%. With the signal, growth rate of 10%. Fairly straightforward. One of the things when and I'm just going to be blunt here and honest, is in reviewing this stuff, is that, you know, for us and looking at that, this is one of those designs. It's retrospective. It's not directed towards the authors at all. It's a very, you know, difficult and challenging environment. Like I said, they're looking at data that was collected for different reasons, but still a retrospective analysis. One of the big ones for us is it was a correlation that the model found a correlation between the variation in growth rates and the years that there was calling, but it's not a causal relationship. And that's an assumption that was made. And the authors provided a rationale for why they made that assumption. And it was really a matter of subtracting what it wasn't, what it probably couldn't have been. And that was left on the table. There was also, it's always easier to find criticisms in work than it is, you know, as when you work on, when you do a manuscript yourself, you think it's great, but of course there comes criticism. And then the assumptions of really, and you think about that response variable, poaching, and the variables that might influence that, really thought maybe could the authors have looked at other variables besides just the signal of calling as a response variable that might influence whether a community poaches or a person poaches or a society poaches. Confounding variables, interaction variables, time lag variables. And so it was in this particular case, the poaching variable wasn't even part of the model. It was just, that was an assumption that it was poaching. And then, of course, as it, working with wolves and knowing that the census information on wolf populations has got quite a bit of variability around that. Estimating wolf populations is very challenging, is usually always a minimum estimate. And really don't have, to our knowledge, doesn't exist a gold standard method of estimating wolf population with both an upper and lower confidence interval that is repeatable. Some of the management implications of that work, we need a greater understanding of the variables that influence social tolerance, greater understanding of the variables that influence poaching. It's certainly something we want to be aware of and thinking about. And I think in terms of lethal removal, it's one that we want to make sure, as reading this and understanding it, is make sure that we're keeping in mind what is the goal of lethal removal in the state of Washington? Is it tolerance? Is it to minimize recurring depredations? What is it, and where do we have the science to back up what that goal is? The next one is Trevis et al., 2016 publication, Predator Control Should Not Be a Shot in the Dark. In this one, the authors, there was actually a review of several different studies. Let me fast forward here. Is a review of several different studies in a couple different areas, in different countries in Europe and in North America. And you can see here cougar and coyote and wolf and black bear and lynx, I think, are in here as well, where they reviewed the functional effectiveness of intervention to protect livestock from wild predators. And so, there's a number, it's a multi-predator system. And intervention, they both looked at tools that are non-lethal and tools that are lethal. So they're reviewing the work that's already been out there for non-lethal and lethal in terms of effectiveness from a global perspective with multiple carnivores. And this one's an interesting one because it actually, when they did the search for all the research that's been done out there, they set up a standard, what they called a gold standard, that said it has to be research that as we described, it was that last most informative tier, where a controlled treatment design, random application into those treatment areas. And they really found that very few of the studies they looked at met that gold standard. And so they then incorporated a silver standard, which wasn't quite as high a bar as the gold standard. It was a quasi-random application of treatment control rather than a perfect system. And everything that they reviewed was peer-reviewed, and these authors in their home countries. And I already mentioned this, they used experimental or quasi-experimental, occurred in working livestock operations with free-ranging native carnivores, and verified livestock losses. Jumping right to the results of this one, so they had 12 tests that met the silver or gold standard. When they reviewed all the literature out there for these carnivores and those two environments that are published and peer-reviewed, which is not many. Of the lethal methods, the studies that use lethal methods, 7 of the tests met the silver standard. None met the gold standard. 2 of the 7, those tests did reduce livestock losses from predation. 3 of the 7, the effects of livestock loss, 2 of the 7 increased livestock losses from predation, 2 of the 7 reduced, and 3 of the 7 had an effect to livestock losses from predation. Of the non-lethal methods, 5 met the test, some gold and some silver. 4 of the 5 did prevent the effects, you know, prevent depredations. 1 of the 4 prevented it for one species but not another species. Here's another way of looking at that same information from the authors. And really what you're seeing here is a little bit of everything. That there are a mix of research out there that meets a higher standard, something, and some that meet a lower standard. And in some areas, the desired effects did occur, and in some areas, it didn't meet the desired effects. And so it just really drives home the message that there is no perfect solution out there that resolves conflict between large carnivores and livestock. Most of the tests, I already mentioned, did not meet the gold standard. More than non-lethal tests did meet the standard. And I think that it's in often cases, as you think about non-lethals, the two that you see here on the slide, the two tests that provided strong inference were phlagery and the use of livestock guardian dogs. And if you think about those in the scope of other tools that are out there and the challenges with using those, you might imagine that the non-lethal tools may be more suitable for these kind of testing environments than the lethal ones. You know, some comments on the study, a good review of multi-carnivore, multi-environment, multi-ecosystem perspective. It highlights the importance, as we talked about early, of the standards we use in our scientific investigations and the need for that rigorousness for controlling confounding factors and interactions and those kinds of things. And really, if at all possible, why it's so important to do that control experimental design with random applications and et cetera. Some management implications from that, of course, more research needed across the board on lethal and non-lethal. We know that. Importance of, again, this ties back to the first one, how important it is for us in Washington to really hone in and talk about what is our objective or our goal of lethal removal of wolves. Is it tolerance? Is it to stop depredations occurring forever? Or is it more short-term than that? And with that, I'm going to pass it to our next presenter here.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Commission Chair, members of the Commission, Director Unsworth. I'm Tara Meyer. I'm the Private Lands and Wildlife Conflict Supervisor in Region 5. And I'm going to be presenting a summary of 3 papers that the department references in developing our wolf management guidelines. So the first 2 I'm talking about are Brainerd et al. And Borg et al. And as you all know, wolf packs can vary in size, and not all adults will breed each year. Both of these papers examine the effects of breeder loss within wolf populations. And Brainerd et al. Pooled worldwide data that was both in published literature and in original unpublished data. And Borg et al. Looked specifically at a long-term study in Alaska from 1986 to 2012. And between the two, they examined how the loss of breeders impact wolf pup survival, wolf reproduction, wolf pack integrity and territoriality, and wolf population growth. And when we're talking about loss of breeder, we're both talking about natural losses, natural death, and human-caused death. In the Borg, or in the Brainerd paper, natural deaths were accounting for 31% of the deaths in cases, and human-caused deaths were 57%. The rest were unknown. And both papers found that these impacts depended on several factors. And these included whether the breeder that was removed was female, male, or both were removed. What was the age of the pups when the breeder was lost? What was the size of the pack, and how many adults were in that pack? Was the pack isolated, or was it surrounded and connected to other packs? What was the size of the surrounding wolf population? Was it large or small? And was that population considered recolonizing, or was it considered saturated? And some examples of the findings include Brainerd et al. Found that breeder loss decreased pup survival to 84%, but the survival rates were higher if there were more than six wolves in the pack. And in most cases, at least one pup did survive, and the presence of non-breeding adults was really important for that, to increase the chance of pup survival. They also found that regarding reproduction, that 47% of packs reproduced the following season when one breeder was lost, and only 9% of packs reproduced the following season when both breeders were removed. Borg et al. Found that in Alaska, wolf packs that dissolved were preceded by breeders' loss of a breeder in 77% of the cases, so it was more common. Packs were more likely to dissolve if a female or both breeders were lost and pack size was small, or if the breeder was harvested during the breeding season. And from these data, Brainerd et al. Recommended limiting lethal control in recolonizing packs. And one thing to note from their study was that the recolonizing packs were considered isolated to some degree from larger saturated populations, which is different from the wolf packs here in Washington, which are connected to the Northern Rockies and Canadian wolves. Brainerd et al. Also recommended that when removal is necessary, to only remove wolves from packs when pups are older than 6 months or packs are larger than six individuals, and ideally those packs would be a part of a larger population, so more than 75 wolves. And as you all know, last year the 2015 census in Washington was 90 wolves, so that's above that number. And Borg et al. Found that although breeder loss had effects on pup mortality and pack integrity at an individual or subpopulation scale, breeder mortality and pack dissolution had no significant effects on immediate or longer-term population dynamics, and that's really important. They also noted that at the population level, socially complex species such as wolves may be resilient to disruption and harvest. And so, in other words, wolves are really adaptable. And as managers, it's important for us to consider the long-term effects of management actions and the effects of effects to the population as a whole. And the third paper I'm going to talk about is Olson et al., 2014. And the authors of this study looked at Wolf Recolonization and Endangered Species Act status in Wisconsin from 2003 to 2011. Using published literature, anonymous questionnaires, and publicly available data, Olson et al. Examined the social dynamics between wolf management, authority changes, public attitudes and acceptance, and illegal wolf hunting and removal. And they found that swings in Wolf Endangered Species Act listing status led to inconsistent management authority, and this caused a decline in local public support for wolves and resulted in a backlash of increased wolf poaching and a legislatively mandated wolf hunt. So from these findings, authors believed illegal killing of wolves may be reduced with consistent and responsible depredation management programs or an incremental delisting transition from federal to state agencies. And finally, Olson et al. Suggested that managers should consider local perceptions of wildlife and seek ways to empower non-conceptive users by providing more opportunities for them to participate. And the department does work to consider wolf management social dynamics and incorporate local perspectives and provide opportunities for stakeholders to participate in wildlife management discussions. Some examples would be the wildlife value study that happened a couple years ago, and data from that has been used in the wolf management plan and other plans, and of course the wolf advisory group, WAG, that has a number of diverse stakeholders, and including non-consumptive users. Thank you.
Do you want to switch?
Yeah, let's do that.
Chair, members of the commission, Director Unsworth. My name is Candace Bennett. I'm the Wildlife Conflict Specialist in Northeast Washington, and I'm going to cover the Bradley et al. Paper from 2015 that looked at lethal removal of wolves and the effects it had on recurrent livestock depredations in Montana. So this was a 20-year study that started in 1989 and had two main objectives. The first objective was to look at how three different management actions would affect recurrent livestock depredations. And what they found was that, and you can see it here. Maybe I should use this. Okay. What you can see here, this is a figure from that that research project where you have the three different management actions, which would be no removals, partial pack removals, and full pack removals. And you can see after that management action, you have full pack removals here in the dotted line, the partial pack removals in the lighter colored line, and then no removals in the dark colored line. And you can see this over time in days and the probability of or the likelihood of recurrent livestock depredations. And what they did find is that partial pack removals did have an effect on whether livestock depredations would occur, but only within 14 days if the removal happened from that first confirmed livestock depredation. And then as they also found that full pack removals also had a significant effect on whether there was livestock depredations. And you can see that here in that dotted line right here. And then you have days. But what they also looked at in that first objective was how did those three management actions affect recurrent depredations when those management actions happen in a specific season or the livestock involved, and they found no significance in those instances. So the other objective was to dive deeper into the partial pack removal and to look at three different variables, so and how that compares to livestock recurrent depredations. So they looked at pack size. They also looked at if a breeding female was removed with that management action. And then finally, if there was a subadult male removed for that management action. And what they found was that larger pack sizes had a higher likelihood of recurrent livestock depredations and no differences when a breeding female or a subadult male was removed. So management implications, this project specifically looked at pack level effects versus a population level effect. So that was one thing that, you know, we think about as managers, you know, that smaller scale, and then referring back to the first part of the presentation where Donnie talked about how informative it was. So this is a pack level project versus this higher population level. With the recommendations that came out of Bradley et al. In 2015, it recommended swifter responses for removals after that first confirmed livestock depredation, so within 14 days. And one of the other implications of that recommendation for recovering wolves is does that compromise recovery efforts after you go in quickly and remove a lot of wolves?
This morning we had a member, as I mentioned, get stuck on the other side of the pass. So early this morning at, I'm not sure what time, Amaruk, but probably 6:30 this morning, I was calling folks in other states and saying, did you get plane tickets and all that? And they did. So we want to make sure we had this. And so he's calling in now, and he's going to do this presentation via phone and speaker and me hitting the buttons. So, Scott, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can barely hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes. So, yes, I'm ready when you are. We're on your first slide where it says perception.
All right. Yeah, thanks for taking the time to listen to this. Sorry, I couldn't make it. The pass did open around 11, but I thought I was going to be scrambling a little too quickly. But, good afternoon, Commission Chair, members of the Commission, and Director Unsworth. My name is Scott Becker. I'm the statewide wolf specialist for the department. And I'm going to take you in a little bit different direction than what's been previously done. We're going to talk a little bit more about the kind of the social side of wolf management as a whole, and then bring in some information from the Northern Rockies that it may not be peer-reviewed peer-reviewed publications, but it's information that we use to help inform us and as to what may occur in the state of Washington as well. So, first off, I want to start out by talking about perception and what that means. So, what is perception? And perception is basically the way you think about or understand someone or something. Next slide, please. And so, what you value tends to shape your perceptions. And these values could be extrinsic values, which are more of the consumptive uses, or intrinsic values, which are the non-consumptive uses. And this is just knowing that something is out there tends to provide somebody with a value. So therefore, depending on your perception of wolves and whether you associate positive or negative values to them, you may have a very different take on this simple photo than the person sitting next to you. If you associate positive values, you may see a symbol of wildness and wild places or the restoration of ecological balance, whereas if you associate negative values to the photo, you might see an animal that only kills for sport, a symbol of economic hardship and government intrusion into your life. So how one values wolves also influences what one perceives as being good science, because no matter your viewpoint of wolves, there's going to be science out there to support it. You know, wolves are one of the most studied animals on the planet, and there are more scientific peer-reviewed publications written about wolves and wolf management than almost any other species on Earth. So even if individuals with different values about wolves read the same publication, their interpretation of that publication can be completely different. Next slide, please. So if one has positive values of wolves, you know, they generally like to focus on the benefits and not the cost of actually having wolves on the landscape. Whereas if one has a negative value of wolves, they generally focus on the cost associated with having wolves on the landscape more so than the benefits. These perceptions become part of how an individual begins to identify themselves, and any attempts at persuasion are interpreted as personal attacks. Individual identity tends to become a group identity, so it's an us versus them concept, and it entrenches more emotions over time. When we identify as us versus them, you know, it's the them all of a sudden turned into a faceless group rather than an individual, and it tends to make them less human. This is part of the reason the WAG was developed, which was basically to try and humanize the issue and let all sides begin to understand the issues from all different perspectives. Next slide, please. So how do managers fit into this equation? Well, kind of the basic goal of wolf recovery and management, to put it very simply, is how do we fit wolves into as many places as possible while minimizing conflict? And then, you know, balancing those opposing views while making management decisions based upon the best available science is always going to be the most challenging part of the job, and that's because of interpretation. And a lot of times we like to say, if you're doing it right, nobody's going to be happy about the decision that you made. You know, as managers, we often look for the preponderance of evidence, and this is often much broader than simply reviewing peer-reviewed literature to gain insight. But we also rely on knowledge, experience, and understanding of the species and data from other areas dealing with similar issues that may or may not be peer-reviewed. There are many little nuances and subtleties of the job that are very important and may be helpful when dealing with a situation that we encounter that may never get published one day. So as managers, you know, we must try to acknowledge viewpoints, but not become drawn in. You know, we can show empathy and understanding, but don't allow emotion to get the better of you, because emotions tend to cloud your judgment and may lead to inconsistencies, which can lead to further challenges down the road. There's a lot of craziness in the wolf world, and so we try as best we can to be the voice of reason, calm things down, be level-headed and rational, and be as objective as possible. You know, as managers, we must be this and not show favoritism to one side of the issue or the other. But managers are also human, and we bring our own set of values onto the playing field, so we must always be cognizant of that and attempt to keep them in check, if at all possible. And the fourth one is normalizing the wolf. You know, as managers, we are most interested in populations and not necessarily individuals within the populations, but the human tendency is to focus on individuals because it's easier to create a story. You know, just because a wolf, or especially a collared wolf, did something doesn't necessarily make it any more important than any other animal or an uncollared wolf doing it. So we try and keep things in perspective. You know, a lot of normalizing the wolf is determined by messaging. It's not only through media outlets, but also how we as an agency react to certain management situations that do arise, and how we implement things on the ground. Next slide, please. So I will give a short, brief, quick little lesson on some kind of the basics of wildlife management, and this pertains very closely to wolf recovery and management as well. So in its very basic terms, wildlife management is the art of balancing biological versus social caring capacity to achieve management objectives or recovery objectives. Next slide, please. So why don't we dive in a little bit more to biological versus social caring capacity. So biological caring capacity is relatively simple. It's how many animals can the habitat support. You know, with wolves are habitat generalists, and in the words of one of the world authorities on wolves, Dave Meach, you know, a wolf only needs two things to survive, something to eat and a place to stand while eating it, and that's very simple. But how that wolf is received by people depends on what it's eating and where he's eating it at. And so this is where social caring capacity comes into play. You know, we live in a human-dominated landscape, and there are very few truly wild places remaining in North America. And because of this, you know, managers must always take into account the social side of wildlife management. And so what exactly is social caring capacity? And that's basically, where will humans allow animals to exist on the landscape? Social caring capacity is not static. It ebbs and flows primarily based on the level of conflict. So a great example of this that's not related to wolves is, I don't know if many of you are familiar, but the elk issues they have in Estes Park, Colorado. You know, folks in Estes Park love their elk and would accept being chased off a golf course by a bull and rut every now and then, or having one eat a few flowers or garden plants every once in a while. But as that population continued to grow and folks couldn't golf anymore because of the number of elk or entire gardens or landscaping were destroyed and wildlife vehicle collisions increased, public opinion started to turn and many wanted elk numbers reduced. So wolf management is no different. Most folks, and even those who don't necessarily value wolves, don't mind having them on the landscape and are willing to accept some level of conflict as long as things don't get out of control. So minimizing conflict is the key to increasing social tolerance for a specific species on the landscape. Next slide, please. So, let's look a little bit more closely at social caring capacity for wolves and how it relates to management. So, prior to wolf reintroduction in 1995, those charged with planning the reintroduction knew that nationwide, public acceptance for the reintroduction was high. But at the local scale, it was relatively low. So to create a level of social tolerance that will allow wolves to recover while minimizing conflict in the early stages of recovery, managers chose to reintroduce wolves into protected areas of Yellowstone Park and French Church Wilderness in Idaho. And you can click it again. And they chose these areas because the human footprint was relatively low and conflicts with livestock would be minimal during these early stages of recovery. So they hoped to achieve some level of social tolerance for having wolves. There was always an expectation that once wolves were reintroduced into these areas, they would have more tolerance of wolves in those spots. Click it again, please. But as wolves grew and expanded out of these protected areas, they began to inhabit more public lands managed for multiple use. So managers understood conflicts were likely to increase as a result of this expansion, but they believe they can manage the conflicts to keep them at an acceptable level. Many who worked with managers, these are private landowners and livestock producers, they also understood that increased conflicts with wolves were likely, even if they were not pleased about having to deal with it. Click it again, please. And as wolves continued to grow in number and expand their range, they began to inhabit more and more of the public-private land interface. And this is where acceptance of conflict is lowest, because things are now happening in your backyard. And attitudes about wolves, or any other wildlife species for that matter, can change very quickly from positive or neutral to negative if conflicts start happening close to home. Next slide, please. So taking the concept of the concentric circles from the previous slide, let's kind of take a peek and see how it relates to the real world. This map right here depicts known wolf packs in the entirety of the northern Rocky Mountains at the end of 2015. As you can see, there are very few protected areas, such as Yellowstone National Park in northwest Wyoming, Glacier Park in northwest Montana. Those are the dark gray areas. And there are large tracts of wilderness areas that aren't depicted on this map, but many of them surround Yellowstone National Park or located in central Idaho as well. But even with these areas, you can see that the majority of known packs do not inhabit these protected areas. Rather, they inhabit primarily multiple use and private lands. And at present, approximately 60 to 70% of all known wolf livestock conflicts occur on private property in the states of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, and not on public grazing allotments. Clicker again, please. So this is a point that we hear often related to wolves and conflicts with livestock, and that is that, in 2015, 61 of 358, which is approximately 17% of known Northern Rockies wolf packs that existed at some point in 2015, were involved in at least one confirmed livestock depredation. But if we look at it a little closer, based on different perceptions of wolves, it highlights how values shape perception, which ultimately provide very different interpretations of the same relatively benign statement. If you have a somewhat negative perception towards wolves, you see the number 61 and think that's way too high and there's a ton of wolves wreaking havoc on the landscape. If you have a more positive outlook towards wolves and perceive primarily benefits, you see 17% and think that's a low number and should be an acceptable number of packs causing conflict. But as a manager, you see 83% of known packs never cause any problems at all. So it's how we manage the remaining 17% that did cause conflict that will dictate where the remaining 83% can or cannot prosper. So I also wanted to highlight one more thing with this map. We tend to think of Washington as being different and separate from everything else. And regarding the legal status of the species in this state, that is true because they have not yet achieved recovery objectives outlined in the plan. But we also have to understand that the wolf population in Washington is a small extension of a much larger metapopulation of wolves in the northern Rockies and Canada. So again, this highlights a more population-level approach to management. Next slide, please. So this map shows the distribution of known packs in Washington at the end of 2015. As you can see, Washington doesn't necessarily have large tracts of protected areas that wolves currently occupy. The most are found on the outer two rings of that circle that we were looking at, which is multiple use and private lands. Click on the next deal, please. And when we look at the number of packs involved in livestock conflicts in the state, we see that we right now aren't much different from the rest of the Northern Rockies, in that at least in 2015, 3 of 20 or 15% of the known packs that existed in Washington at some point during that year were involved in at least one confirmed livestock depredation. Next slide, please. So I understand that this is a pretty busy slide, and I'll explain it in a few seconds, but I wanted to use it to highlight how managers might use data from other states to provide useful information, which might assist with better understanding the species in our own state. There will be three main points I hope to get across with this slide, but let me try and explain it to you first. The black line shows the minimum estimated wolf population at the end of each calendar year from 2000 to 2015, and that's the top line on the figure there. The dashed gray line shows the number of known human-caused wolf mortalities each year. It does not include natural or unknown causes, so these are only known human-caused mortalities. The bars at the bottom show the number of confirmed livestock losses caused by wolves each year for both sheep and cattle, and this does not include lost or missing livestock at all. So first, I wanted to visit a little bit about trends. Managers understand they can't count every animal in the landscape, so they do their best to estimate numbers using a variety of techniques. And then look at overall trends over time to inform them about population status. Wolves are no different. And as wolves expanded in number and range, estimates became less precise. And for this reason, we also look at trends over time. Around 2009, the trend in wolf populations in the Northern Rockies appeared to level off and may be beginning to fluctuate and round an equilibrium of sorts. Even though human-caused mortality increased over that time period. Data from other wolf populations suggest wolves can sustain somewhere between 30 to 50% annual mortality rate while continuing to maintain stable to slightly increasing populations, understanding that specific rate will vary due to a host of other factors. And in the Northern Rockies, since 2011, when legal hunts were initiated, human-caused mortality is averaged right around 30% of the known population. It's from a low of about 23% in 2011 to a high of 36% of the known population in 2013. So I wanted to highlight the trends in livestock depredations as well. You know, when managers look at trends over time, we primarily examine cattle because they're more consistent over time, whereas sheep depredations are highly variable on an annual basis. And so on this figure, the black portion of the bars represent cattle depredations, and the lighter colored bars represent the sheep depredations. And over time, the number of cattle depredations slowly increased with increasing wolf populations up until about the time wolf estimates leveled off. And from around 2006 to 2012, there was an average of slightly over 190 confirmed cattle depredations per year. But as the wolf population leveled off and legal hunts were initiated in other states, the number of cattle depredations has decreased to an average of less than 150 per year. In 2015, Idaho had 35 confirmed cattle depredations, while Montana had 41, even though those two states had an estimated 1,300 to 1,500 wolves during those years. You know, this is a small amount of data right now, but it's a trend that we'll continue to monitor to see if it continues. And lastly, although it's difficult to tease out in this figure, in visiting with managers from other states, there is some indication that with the implementation of legal take, average pack size has declined, although the total number of wolves on the landscape has remained relatively stable. Can this partially account for the observed decrease in the number of cattle depredations? We don't know for sure right now because we don't have enough information to say one way or the other, but it is an interesting topic that will continue to be monitored over a longer period before any specific conclusions are drawn. Next slide, please. So, what about Washington? Yes, Washington has experienced livestock depredations in the state. And yes, we have had wolves die by human causes as well as other causes. But when you look at population trends, aside from one year, it appears to have had, minimal impact on the population as a whole. And next slide, please. So how do we try and navigate the somewhat craziness of wolf management and continue to achieve our recovery objectives in the state of Washington? I think one of the things we can do, and we touched on it earlier, is continue to try and normalize them and basically manage wolves as you would any other species. Just because a wolf did something doesn't make it a bigger deal than any other critter doing the exact same thing. As managers, we want to manage the population and not necessarily the individual. And so if the population as a whole is doing well, then we're inching closer to recovery objectives, then we're doing good. We want to do this by continuing to review and contributing to the best available science. And then we also want to develop and implement consistent management strategies for the species, because that consistency is a key to successful management for any species, not only wolves. Because if people know what to expect coming down the pipeline, then it's easier for them to accept as well. And that assists in building social tolerance. And eventually will lead to trust, which will make management not easy by any stretch, but a little easier than it is right now. And next slide, please. And that is, I'll leave you with that quote by Dave Meach, and I guess we'll go ahead and take any questions.
I have one other quick update. Thank you, Scott. So in terms of next steps and a little of that, here today, we just scratch the surface, obviously, of the research that's out there in the science, and it's hard to convey that if you're not reading the paper and try to summarize it in a few minutes like we did, but give you a taste of that. Next steps for us is, of course, we're right now, the department's working internally and also with stakeholders, the Wolf Advisory Group and stakeholders beyond the Wolf Advisory Group, and taking this information, looking at it and thinking about it and how it can inform those decisions and that policy. And that being said, you know, there are some parts of the protocol that we have that are they're social calls. There's it's not a science question. And there are other parts where their decision space includes science, and science informs that those decisions in that space. Another item is that I'm going to plug it one more time that we are constantly, you know, reviewing and participating and doing research ourselves. I just wanted to touch on some collaborative research with WSU. We have a number of students that are presenting next month at the State Wildlife Society chapter meeting from WSU. They've been working on the wolf livestock research that's coming to some conclusion now, and seeing those first public presentations in March. And then also participating in joint with University of Washington on a very large-scale predator-prey investigation that it's occurring right now in northeastern Washington and north-central Washington, where we're radio-collaring and monitoring over 100 different, I think the sample size is 150 or even larger, of deer, elk, and moose in those systems, and wolves and cougars and maybe even other carnivores. So some research that we're participating in there. And then lastly, again, just the importance of science is that, and coordination is that, I've been visiting with my boss, Eric Gardner, and Director Unsworth about reaching out to WAFWA and maybe perhaps creating a wolf working group in WAFWA or whatever that step looks like for that collaboration with other states and universities on whether it's a science question or coordination and management and those kinds of things. So with that, we'll take any questions you have. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. That was great. That was very good. Let me just start off with one question. What Scott just said, the wolf is not any different than any other critter. And, you know, science-y, yeah, that's true. But the wolf has been the baggage of the myths forever. I mean, you know, the wolf's been demonized from the get-go. And, I mean, we're fortunate to have an organization like Wolf Haven, but that, you know, how do you demonize something that from childhood people, you know, it's, I remember somebody saying that it was a papal decree, I think, that were back in the Dark Ages, that branded the wolf as the dog of the devil. And I often thought, what if the Pope would have gone against a groundhog, how that would have changed history or something, but, you know. So the wolf is different. I mean, that's not really a question. It's just kind of, you know, it's a frustration. So with that, I'll open it up to real questions.
Thank you. Donnie, that was, I believe I was one of the commissioners that wanted to see something like this. And I think without having a big forum and all kinds of expense, this was really valuable and appreciate, especially your comments as you started off, because what you were saying made, I think everyone needs to take and really pay attention to it. You know, science does not make these decisions. You know, science is informing the decision makers. And it's just so easy to cherry pick the science you like and say, oh, that, see, as opposed to saying, learn from each body of science and have that affect how we look at this whole process. I was somewhat, I believe this is some of the latest science that's out there, and it's a little bit surprising that it hasn't changed all that much since we were a part of that forum. Was that in 2012? I mean, we're still going back to Trevis and Brainerd and all that, and that's okay if that's where we're at. I wanted to point out that, like, the Trevis papers was dealing, I believe, a little bit more with the sheep situations. You know, as you look at that data, you can see the things that worked for them were guard dogs and flattery. So that's good. We have sheep problems in this state, but we also have, you know, probably a majority of our problems deal with cattle. The Brainerd papers and Borg dealt more with the recovery aspects. What are the effects on wolf pups, which is also an important question, because we are in recovery. We can't ever ignore that. I think the Bradley and Jimenez paper is one of the few that dealt with what are the effects of the actions you're taking on the depredations that are occurring. So I'd like us to keep our eyes wide open for other research that's coming in that gives us more information on that part of the equation, and to just comment that we're in a unique situation. We're in recovery in parts of our state that are recovered. You know, Northeast is essentially full of wolf territory. The wolf territories are full. And yet, you know, part of our plan said we have to use that source of wolves to fill in the other parts of the state. And I think we all understand that. And yet the frustration level that builds in Northeast Washington by producers and livestock owners and that population, it's real. You can't ignore that either. So I appreciate what you've put together today, what all the different speakers have said, and just ask that this commission continue to think about this in terms of, we don't cherry-pick science. We eventually will have to take everything that's provided through science, as well as on-the-ground real-life stories from conflict specialists, from our biologists, from the latest research coming out, because it's a tough decision. I mean, we've got to think about this whole concept of one part of our state is at recovery, and yet, you know, what's required there might be different, and yet we can't necessarily have a regional delisting, but possibly there's ways to manage that population at a different level. I didn't have a question either. I wanted to thank you for coming and doing a good job. Then ramble on a bit.
Mine is more of a statement as well. I thank you. Want to particularly highlight Scott's emphasis on normalizing the wolf. And as I was listening to all the presentations, and his in particular, and his bringing out that point, recalling my experience as a public health physician whose career spanned HIV. I was there at the beginning of the epidemic, as it turned into sort of a much less visible chronic disease over a period of 30 years. And we also early on sort of treated it, we came to call it HIV or AIDS exceptionalism. We were treating it differently than other public health problems. And it was challenging us. And I was actually chair of the State Board of Health here when we made testing for HIV the same as doing the blood test for anything else. So prior to that decision by the State Board of Health, we had to go through extreme consent procedures in order to test somebody for HIV. It was pretty controversial. That was a hearing where we had a room full of people who were opposing that change to make, but it was a step toward normalizing it. And I know that this has come up before the WAG, that it's time to really start changing some of our approach to management as steps toward normalizing it. And it's going to be hard to do. But the commission bears some responsibility. I'm actually going to bring a blue sheet to ask that since most of us now on the commission were not here during the development of the Wolf Plan, but to bring a briefing and perhaps some staff recommendations about is it time to take a look at this and do we need to update it? Because I think in order to accomplish normalizing, all of us are going to have to take some bold steps that just start changing some of those approaches to make wolves more like all the other animals that we manage. The same thing we did with HIV. It's now pretty normal. So.
Thank you. Any other?
I think you did an excellent job, despite the nervousness about stepping on toes and stepping on landmines and
yeah.
whatever else, criticizing some of our collaborators. I think you did a really great job. You brought to the fore a lot of issues that will take me some time to digest, but I think it really was excellent. Brought up a lot of perspectives that we need to digest and remember to consider. And as you're talking about normalizing, I was thinking in terms of what we also have to normalize is the diversity of opinion and the fact that some of these conflicts are going to go up and down, like the populations that some of the very important points to make is that as we have more wolves moving westward, we're going to have more conflicts with more people. And particularly if there is no resolution to the fact that we don't have any management control beyond Highway 97, federal listing will make it impossible for us to do anything about the conflicts. So we're getting into more difficult territory, I think, in the history of wolf recovery. And it has to do with the spread of wolves under more private lands as they, you know, the circles expand. We're in a more polarized national environment politically, which is going to change, likely to disrupt and change potential for inconsistent management going up and down, I think, is increased. So, and then on top of that, what really is going to be hugely difficult is dealing with the impacts of wolves on ungulates and the expectations that we have raised to our hunting community, the importance of hunters in our financial picture. All of those things create this train coming at us that's going to be really difficult for us because of just difficulties with the science, and the litigiousness, the polarization. So as we try to tackle this goal that we have of managing wolf populations to protect ungulates or hunter opportunity, it's just going to get that much more difficult. And that's why you guys deserve every penny that you make. And we'll just have to keep talking. I welcome the idea of looking again at the wolf recovery policy / plan. Has a lot of moving parts. And I think one of the things we heard when we developed that plan, we had a commissioner from Idaho, a county commissioner from Idaho, came and testified. And his gem of wisdom that he imparted was, you'll never know how this is going to turn out until you're in the middle of it. You know, you just can't predict. So you have to be flexible, nimble, intelligent, learning all the time. So excellent job, you guys. It was just a skirting the surface.
Thank you.
I thought of a question. where was that presentation by the WSU researchers going to be? And to whom?
I think it's at the TWS chapter meeting in Yakima.
I would put in a good word for that. I've had the good fortune to get to know some of those researchers, and particularly Azura Valerio is leading one part of that study. I don't know if she's going to be speaking there, but I've had enough opportunity to see a little bit of what's come out of that. You know, a little bit hesitant to share too much, but I think that's the type of research that's going to be fascinating. It's going to point the way towards, you know, helping us make decisions. And in particular, it's about, you know, depredations that are occurring, how wolves and livestock interact. You know, some of the neat things I've seen were, you know, how often they do interact with each other, and there's no problem. You know, they're part of the 87% or 82% that don't cause any problems. I mean, they're not just because they're not near them. They're moving in and out of the cattle and all the time, but they're just not causing problems. So there's some really neat stuff that's going to come out of that, as well as what are some of the effects of those interactions and the stress hormones and whatnot. And I'd encourage people to, you know, when that comes out, or at least even as you're being briefed on it, to attend if you can.
Right. Mr. Chair, can I leave one more comment? One other item I was thinking about here as I heard the statements and stuff that I wanted to leave you with is, it is growth. I mean, when I say growth, not wolf population growth, but growth of our society, growth of our agency, we're in a growth phase where we're all learning. And just as Commissioner Wecker talked about, when the commissioner from Idaho came over, you until you're into that growth, you really can't experience or know what it is. But what I can say about it for Washington is that, and you know, we're looking back now over the last year, the last 5 years, and making changes and tweaks, and we're working on protocol and those kinds of things, is that we do recognize that Washington is different. Washington is not the Northern Rocky Mountain ecosystem. We learn from it. We learn from the Great Lakes. We learn from the Southwest. But we see Washington as different. Our tool chest is not just lethal removal of wolves. Our tool chest for dealing with wolf-livestock conflict, there are many, many non-lethal things that we use. And we haven't done a good job in the past of it tends to be looking back at our last protocol, it's a protocol for lethal removal. And now as we're talking, preparing for working with the WAG, really broadening that out and talking about it as it's a protocol for addressing wolf-livestock conflict. And it includes lethal and non-lethal. And we have lots of tools in the toolbox. And so just leave you with that part that we do see Washington as different, and we are, you know, working with our Washington base and carving that out, what that looks like in Washington, but thinking of this as progressive as well, and that lots of tools in the toolbox.